Olá pessoas, sejam bem-vindos a mais um Momicast, eu sou a Nath e o episódio de hoje é muito especial porque eu vou ter a honra de entrevistar a Paul Hobbs, que está aqui comigo. Esse podcast vai ser gravado totalmente em inglês, que é a língua que Paul conversa, mas como a gente está fazendo em vídeo, este vídeo tem legendas em português, então quem estiver ouvindo no carro, dá um pause e volta para casa que você pode assistir um vídeo com a legenda, o que vai facilitar a sua vida. Eu tenho um tempo muito curto hoje, então vai ser um episódio mais curtinho, de apenas 30 minutos, mas tudo para conversar com o Paul Hobbs e trazer um pouquinho de novidades para vocês. Paul, I cannot express how happy I am to have you here. I know your schedule is insane here in Brazil, but thank you so much for taking your time to talk to me and to my listeners.
What a pleasure. Thank you, Nat. Coming here.
Well, we have short time, so I'm going
to
go straight away. Yeah. You started producing wine a long time ago in Argentina when the world didn't even know Argentina was a country that was producing wine. What were the most challenging thing about producing wine in a country that is not well developed in wine and the rest of the world didn't know yet?
Yeah. Well, I think you've got two questions in one. Well, I think in terms of whether it was even possible to grow high quality wine grapes that would be appropriate for the international market was question number one. And then, of course, it's learning what the situation is in a brand new place, in a culture that, well, is relatively foreign to me, as I had no experience ever in being in South America. And then I think there was bias in the sense that I was up against some preconceived ideas that had been sort of implanted in my head prior to my arrival to Argentina. So I think overcoming all those, but the biases melted away pretty quickly. And because as soon as I saw the place and saw what was good, but I also saw what wasn't good. But the good thing, actually the great thing, was that what was good was the things that were difficult to change. And what wasn't so good were things that were relatively easy to change. And so that triggered like a little light bulb in my head as well, this country could be a powerhouse in the international market. And so I wanted to be a part of seeing if I could help steer it in that direction.
It was like a blank canvas. You could do anything you wanted because nothing was being explored by the time.
At that time, you're correct. I mean, the industry was producing what was considered by the international community some of the worst wines in the world, which was sort of sad and unfortunate. The good part of that is that only a few people had an opinion about Argentina. The majority of wine consumers around the world had no idea about Argentina, so there was no baggage associated. And that made it easier to penetrate. If we could do something, we reasoned, if we could do something well, then that would probably be quite compelling, because also Argentina had some other important, you might say, aspects that would be emblematic of the country. It had positive cultural, let's say, touch points, such as the gauchos and the tango and just the sort of sophisticated lifestyle that was pretty much world known. And so if we could complement that with wine, we could couple that with these things that already were associated with Argentina around the world. And that seemed to be an opportunity, which could, by the way, be much more difficult in some other countries.
Well, yesterday you told us a pretty fun story about how you got to Argentina, because actually you were going to Chile. Would you mind telling us pretty fast? Because I think our listeners are going to love the story.
Well, frankly, because of my preconceived bias, I was resistant. But there was an insistent ex-classmate friend of mine and his brother that wanted me to come to Argentina. I was looking for a new challenge in my life. I was sort of in that, you know, crossroads, the crosshairs of I'm in my mid-30s. I've done this work with Opus One, Robert Mondavi, and Simi Winery. And that had consumed, you know, 10 to 12, 13 years of my life. But where next? What would I do next? Where could I go to really make a difference? And Chile resonated with me because, well, people were basically saying, there's a lot of room for development, but it could be the next great wine region of the world. And this, of course, is the mid to late 80s. So I organized a trip to Chile through a classmate friend of mine from University of California, Davis. His name is Marcelo Cove. We were very close friends, and he was obliging, and he organized a whole week of trips, 2 visits per day, so a total of 10 visits. But in those days, we didn't have the communication capacity that we have today, so I decided, well, this other fellow from Argentina has been sort of pestering me to visit Argentina and look at his family's vineyards with him and see if I could help them. So I invited this gentleman, his name, Catena, Jorge Catena, as a matter of fact, the younger brother of Nicolas. And when he came, what I didn't realize, of course, is that there was this border dispute. There had been border disputes. And Chile and Argentina had a sort of a significant tension between the two countries. And so my host, when he found out what I had done, was furious with me. He was quite so angry. So I told Jorge, listen, Kogan is unhappy. Please return. I'm sorry I made a mistake. But Jorge refused to return quietly. He didn't say he wasn't going to go back. He said, I'm in no hurry. I have no place to go. I'll just hang around. I said, no, Jorge, that's not good. Don't hang around.
You have to go.
You have to leave. But he didn't. And so finally, Kogan got frustrated enough with the two of us. And he said, if you can't get rid of him, I'm going to get rid of both of you. So you have to leave. And so that's what led me to Argentina, against my will, but in the end, it worked out quite nicely. And we drove over the Andes on a Friday morning. And Jorge, of course, I didn't know this at the time, but he's partially blind. So he had difficulty navigating the Caracoles going up the backside of the Andes and into Mendoza. But that was a very moving experience when we started to descend into the Mendoza region. I saw the first vineyard there, and I was very impressed with the soils and with the close spacing, which was something I thought the soils were superior to the ones that I've been seeing in Chile, and also thought their tight spacing was more quality-oriented. But then the farming wasn't very good. So I thought, well, but that's something we can fix.
That's the easy part.
That could be maybe not easy, but at least it was something we could take on. Replanting a vineyard is much more difficult.
Well, when you got to Argentina, Malbec was produced in bulk. It was a volume wine, low quality wine. And you insisted in producing a great Malbec. Well, now you produce great Malbecs. But what was the first Malbec you produced that you thought, okay, yeah, that was it. That was it that I was looking for, the first one.
Well, basically, yeah. You know, maybe just a little prelude to that. I was brought to Argentina by Nicolas Catena to focus on Chardonnay. And his reasoning was that if we could convince the Americans that we could grow high-quality whites, and we were going through, in California, kind of a revolution in Chardonnay winemaking. So we were studying many different aspects and changing the way we were making the wine. And Nicolas was fascinated by it. And we were improving the quality quite dramatically year on year. So he wanted to be connected to that. And he thought that if we could make great whites, we could make great the Americans would automatically assume high quality reds. So I returned to Argentina in 89 to work on Chardonnay, barrel fermented Chardonnay to be specific. And it was really tough going, but we had good vineyards, but we didn't have modern equipment. In fact, it was ancient equipment. But during this period of time, where every morning for the 2-week period that I was there, we would go out into the vineyards And I was keep on it. Can we go higher in elevation? Can we go to cooler sites? Because Argentina had the reputation of being too warm for high quality wine grapes. So, and my hosts, Pedro Marcheschi and Carlos Vasquez, were very accommodating. So we would explore some of the cooler districts, but they weren't really planted to red wine varietals. And so that became quite interesting to go there. Then I went to Nicholas and saying, well, you know, we've seen this variety Malbec growing in the vineyards. There's some beautiful, there's a beautiful one, which was his, in a little district near the Rio Mendoza River, just sitting on the ledge just above the Rio Mendoza. There was old vines, high density, beautiful alluvial soils, and the roots were extremely deep. And I was thinking, oh, well, lest we have to try making Malbec from here, it could be very good. But we're going to have to change the way it's farmed. So that's why I approached Nicolas and asked him if he would be open to that. And he said no, which was a little bit surprising to me that he would just flat out say no, because he was otherwise quite willing to try various things. But I guess because of the years of Malbec being made as a low-quality grape in Argentina for blending purposes, he had no quality perception. He felt that it had no capability of making a noble wine. But, so he had his reasons for that. But I felt, well, why not? Why not just go ahead and try it anyway? And fortunately, Nicholas didn't live in Mendoza. He lives in Buenos Aires. So I felt, well, it won't hurt to make a little, to convert some of his vineyard. And so I enlisted the help of Pedro Marcheschi. And he agreed, convert the vineyard, irrigate it less, change the trellis system to my requests and so on and so forth. And then we made 10 barrels, but I had to get the barrels because I couldn't use container barrels, so I had to get the barrels. So those I sourced from French cooper based in Cognac, Tegan Moreau, as a matter of fact, and Alain Fouquet was the cooper. And I actually started with 10 American oak barrels, and so I aged the wine in those barrels. And so when the U.S. press came to launch Catena Chardonnay into the market, which was March of 1993, after we showed them the Chardonnay, and they seemed to be very happy with the work that we had done, and they were going to write some glorious words about Chardonnay, I said, well, I think it's a good time to show them the Malbec. So I said, well, I have one more thing I'd like to show you that I had in the back of the winery. And that's kind of what began the push for Malbec. Because one gentleman, as I've mentioned before, as you know, Tom Stockley, writing for the Seattle Times, he wrote about the Chardonnay, of course, in an article, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. But his real epiphany, he said, was how good the Malbec was. And he thought that might one day be the signature variety of Argentina, and how prophetic his words were.
How long ago was that?
Well, the article came out roughly, let's say, late April of 1993. We launched Catena for the first time. Chardonnay, the first Catena bottling, was launched in May 1993 into the U.S. market, basically Virginia, Washington, D.C., New York, first on the East Coast before it moved across the country.
How long after that you think America started to understand and enjoy Malbec? How long for the prophecy?
Well, first we had to create it because Nicholas didn't want to put Malbec, he didn't want his name associated with a variety. But because of the pressure, because this article from Tom Stockley got syndicated into other outlets such as Washington Post, the Chicago Times, and other major newspapers. And so our importer, Alfredo Bartholomeos from Billington Imports in Virginia, and Robert Parker himself was pushing pressure to make some Malbec. And Nicholas was very resistant to that. So I said, well, we've got to come with a new brand. And so he came to me and said, well, Paul, you've kind of got me into this situation. So you're going to get me out. And so what I did was create a brand called Alamos. Of course, Nicholas funded all of this, and Nicholas then told me, well, as you create this brand, you're going to be the importer because you're the only person that the Americans will believe. And in fact, I think he was right. I think it was brilliant, but I was very resistant. I had no desire to be an import company, but I did form one, and I became the importer of Alamos. I introduced Malbec. First, we basically introduced it to the U.S. market without any marketing budget, and basically people didn't even know about Argentina in the U.S. They thought, when I would explain to them, for example, about Malbec and Mendoza and Argentina, invariably the question I would get at the end was, what part of Chile did you say that was? So I had a lot of, I felt, wow, this is going to be very difficult. You know, how am I going to help train? And then I said, well, my distributor in New York said, well, send me 3 cases of wine. So, wow, 3 cases of wine. That's not going to go over. So this, it looked like it was going to fail, basically. And then about a month later, after the wine was, a small amount of wine got out, I would get a call out of the blue and say, this is Michael Skernick, or this is so-and-so. We're well-known distributors. And they would say, I have a customer sitting next to me and he wants to tell you something. So, okay. And so then for $9 a bottle or $10 a bottle, this is the best wine I've ever had in my life. And so then my distributor would get back on the line and said, send me a pallet, which is 56 cases. Okay, now we're talking. And so by word of mouth, the word got out. Malbec, or I also had some Chardonnay and Cabernet, but that's how we launched the first successful Malbec. It wasn't done with marketing dollars. It was just word of mouth and me going into the market and talking to people and so on and so forth. And then after we launched and had some success, then of course, Cateno wanted to capitalize on that. And so then I began making wine under the Cateno label with Malbec as the main variety.
It's a great story. Well, we're now celebrating 25 years of Vinacopos. So much has changed since 25 years ago. You have many projects around the globe. You travel a lot. Is there anything you miss from the times you were like in your mid-30s, just producing wine and not traveling that much?
Well, actually, when my reputation sort of got out that I had done this for Argentina, other people from other countries, because I've always enjoyed going to places that are less traveled and seeing what we could do to help reinvigorate or maybe start something fresh entirely. So that's why I've gone to Cahors, of course, but that sort of is a tie back to the homeland in Malbec. But I think it might be one of the first times that an American has ever been invited into France to help raise the image of one of their regions. And so I would get more and more calls to go to different parts of the world. Some I chose not to do, and others I accepted. But so there was quite a lot of travel as soon as, like, this time I was in my mid-30s. And there's quite a lot of travel, and that's the way it's been ever since. For the last 35 years, I've been traveling to various regions of the world making wine. And when you do that, frankly, when you go to a new region, you might think that, well, it's easier after you have your first child, the next child's going to be easier, right? But you know it's not. And each child requires a tremendous, well, we say a community to raise a child, right? But each child requires a tremendous amount of work. And typically, you may learn something in one place and think you can apply it in another, but in fact, most cases, you can't make an application. Cultures are different, infrastructures are different, climatic and other factors. So I've found that every endeavor is almost like the first. It's heavy lifting. And unless you pay a tremendous amount of attention to it, it never really gets off the ground. So you've got to spend the time.
Well, once Robert Parker called you the truffle hunting dog because of the philosophy of explore, looking for new places. And is the spirit still alive? Are you still looking for different places?
Not as much, no, because, well, I have a young family. 10-year-old daughter, 7-year-old daughter, and I want to spend time with them. Because in my, for a 20-year period, I was so busy that I really neglected any kind of personal life, which was fine with me at the time. But now that I have lovely family and so on and so forth, of course, it's very important. I must say, though, I'm very lucky because I met my wife here in Sao Paulo and hosting a wine event for a client, Toso, Bodegas Toso. And it just so happens that her parents were born in Buenos Aires. And so I guess you could say that's fortuitous because at the end of the day, she understands the places where I work and she's connected to those places, which would be a lot more difficult if my most significant person in my life didn't understand or have any connection with these places that I go and work. And so she joins me, our children also, they love coming to Argentina. I haven't brought them to Brazil yet, but I think that's going to change next year.
And any plans to explore outside Mendoza, but still in Argentina, different regions?
I think I've worked in most of the regions, and I find them very interesting and compelling. So I love Cafayate in the north and Salta, and I find it very interesting and fun. I mean, it's great fun to work in places like Neuquén, Rio Negro. And I know, of course, there's other things happening in Djibouti. If I do more of that, it's so time-consuming getting to these places. Sadly, it's not... With COVID, has changed the ability to go from point A to point B. And so I've decided, no, I'm going to focus. We have such a great thing going with Viña Cobos that I just want to put all my energies and focus when I'm in Argentina on this great company that started as a little gleam in my eye and has grown to be a beautiful company.
And it's now is a quarter century company, 25 years. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We reached the last question, and I just want to say that I'm a fan of your work, and you, of course, know the Brazilians are great fans of Bodega Cobos, Viña Cobos, and if you want to send a message for your Brazilian fans, be my guest.
Well, of course. It's not so much a question as it is. But I actually appreciate the opportunity very much. Well, I think what I'd like to say to the beautiful people of Brazil is that without them, we probably would be a much different company. Brazil's enthusiasm for our work, there's something, a joie de vivre, if you will, about they come and visit our winery, and they are uplifting, they lift our spirit, in fact. And so we love our connection with Brazil, frankly, and it's a very important connection. It means a great deal to us, and it's the Brazilian relationship that we have is very dear to our hearts. And they, you know, it's important when you're doing work that somebody appreciates the work that you're doing. And no other people anywhere in the world seem to appreciate it more than the people here in Brazil. So thank you very much for that. We're going to keep working hard for you.
Oh, we appreciate so much. And we thank you for the great wines. We really enjoy.
Thank you.
It's always been a pleasure. I cannot say how grateful I am for you taking these 30 minutes to talk to me. And that's it.
Great, wonderful.
Great.
Well, thank you. Have a wonderful fim de ano.
Thank you. You too. É isso, pessoas. Espero que tenham gostado. Nos vemos na próxima sexta-feira, ao meio-dia. Um beijo e até mais.